30, so I'm going to go ahead and call this meeting to order. Ms. Folks, can you do a roll call?
Yes, Dr. Davis-Wilson. This is Jennifer. I will be doing the roll call. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Here.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Excellent. Thank you. I apologize. All right. We will move now to agenda item number 4, approval of minutes, the March 6, 2020 regular session minutes and the March 6, 2020 executive session minutes. Do we have a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion to approve.
And do we have a second?
Yep, Dr. Davey, second.
Excellent. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The minutes have been approved. We are going to move on now to agenda item number 5, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding complaints and recommendations to the board. A person of or a representative of a person who has filed or received the complaint and who is present may make a brief statement to the committee. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. Please use only initials for patients or children. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. The complaint for review today is 20-32 for Karen Peterson. I am recused from this case, so Dr. Stenhoff will take the lead. Will you please provide the committee an overview?
I want to disclose that I've been in meetings with one of the individuals listed in the complaint, KB, but can review this case without bias. So I'll be providing the committee with an overview. First, again, I'd like to thank the board staff for organizing the paperwork for this case. It makes it easier to go through all the details. So to begin my summary, the complainant, JG, previously alleges that KB, the owner of Breakthrough Academy, was alerted that a child whose name is CB was hit by a non-certified staff member in November of 2019. In addition, Karen Peterson, who was a licensed behavior analyst on staff, did nothing about the situation. In addition, KB was advising staff to use restrictive holds and restraints to staff who are not trained to these interventions. JG, the complainant, is concerned that non-certified staff are going beyond their scope of training. In response, Ms. Peterson included that JG was not currently working for the agency at the time of the alleged incident with CB. In regard to alerting KB of the incident between staff and CB, this does not involve Ms. Peterson. She informed KB about the incident that occurred on November 7th of 2019. In regard to the allegation that Ms. Peterson did nothing about the situation, Ms. Peterson believes that it was related to a staff member blocking a student from spitting on him. Ms. Peterson also reported the information to her supervisor, who was employed at the agency at the time, AP. In regard to KB telling staff to use restrictive holds and restraints, this allegation refers to KB and not Ms. Peterson. Regarding the non-certified staff being trained using holds beyond scope, Ms. Peterson reported that she is CPI certified. One final comment is the incident involving the student CB was under police investigation of March 27th of 2020. At this point, this completes my review. Ms. Peterson, her attorney, are on the phone. Is there anybody else who is requested to speak regarding this matter?
Dr. Stenhoff, there is not.
Okay. All right. So will the licensee in this matter please feel free to speak? To let you know, the committee may have questions for you during this time.
Thank you, Doctor, and the committee. This is Tricia Schaefer, Ms. Peterson's counsel. Ms. Peterson is certainly here and available to answer any questions directly and to give her own statement. I'm not going to interfere with that at all. The only point I would make is that, you know, I had specifically followed up with Ms. Michelson after the receiving the board's report to see if any further information had been provided by JG or AP, and nothing. It's been crickets, to use in terms of parlance, and it seems here that this is somehow an issue between JG and the school, or addressing some institutional issues, and Ms. Peterson is the only licensee involved and therefore is the only one here to talk about it. And with that, unless anyone has any questions for me, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Peterson.
Well, I guess I don't really have anything to say. I was really confused when the complaint was made because JG was my mentor and had been helping me with everything at the school. And what?
I think that's just some interference.
Oh.
I think you're fine.
Okay. So I really was shocked and surprised when the incident occurred. I reported it to AP and KB and was told that AP would investigate, and so he talked to me later in the day, and I answered, told him what I knew. I did not witness the incident. I was just told about it, and in the report that we got from the board, JG says that AP has extensive knowledge, so it seems that he did investigate. I was not told to do anything other than what I had already done, so I just assumed that the people that I reported it to would take care of everything that needed to be done. It wasn't until my lawyer talked with someone at the board that we realized that maybe it needed to be reported and had not been reported. So at that time, which was January, I believe, 22nd, I reported it to the Phoenix police.
Any further comments from Ms. Peterson or Ms. Schaefer?
I don't have anything else to say unless people have questions for me.
Okay. All right. And okay. So I would like to hear if any of my board members do any of you have any questions for either of these two people?
So this is Dr. Davia. I just wanted to hear from Ms. Peterson in her words, just with regard to overall, as licensed behavior analysts and other professionals working across the state, our duty to report. And maybe you can just kind of opine on, how you've had to engage in that behavior in the past, or how the situation was different in those terms, and just kind of give us a sense of your understanding of that duty.
In reporting?
Duty to report if there's been neglect.
Well, my past experience in reporting has been as a teacher. I have reported to DPS, I don't know what they call themselves now, but it was always in terms of a child who told me about incidents at home. So I this was the first time it was ever involved an employee at a school. And I was so new to the school and had never been in a position of administration before that I just felt that I should take it to my supervisors. And really that's what I did as a teacher too. I would go to my principal or someone and say, you know, here's what the student told me. Should I report this or, you know, what do you think? And usually they would say, yes, report it, or no, I wouldn't, you know, that's not something I would typically report.
And just for the record, you did not, having reviewed the records, you did not see the incident occur, correct?
No, I was inside. The incident happened outside. The only person who saw it was the person who told me about it. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but there was, this was one of multiple complaints made by the same person against the other person. So when I reported it to, and he also reported it to AP, you know, in the back of my mind, I was thinking that AP would either discover that this was a false claim, or if he determined that it was a legitimate complaint, that he would do whatever he needed to do about it. So when nothing came of it, I just kind of thought it was had become a personnel issue. And that's why I didn't, you know, think too much of it after that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have no further questions.
Do any other members have any questions?
I didn't see in the records, but it's my understanding, Dr. Stenhoff, that the individual who filed the complaint is not a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Arizona. Is that your understanding as well?
That's my understanding as well, yes, Dr. Davey, yeah.
And yet was practicing behavior analysis as a consultant for the schools, correct?
That would be my understanding, yeah.
Thank you.
I have some questions related to timeline. There was, in the documentation, it was indicated that JG left his consulting role on October 31st of 2019. The incident was reported occurred on November 7th of 2019, so seven days after his departure from the agency or his consulting relation with the agency. Is that accurate? Or is that your take too, Ms. Peterson?
Yes, okay. That's accurate.
Can you discuss for me how, or I guess it's more of a guess, but how JG might have been informed of this incident if he was not involved with the school any longer?
I didn't know either until later. KB told me that they were, she and AP and JG were at a conference together at the time that the incident occurred, and that's how he knew, I guess. They discussed it there.
Okay. All right. Did AP provide any further information? I'm going to back up just a little bit. You were made aware that an incident occurred between the staff member and CB And just for clarity, is that the, did you speak with that staff member, debrief with that staff member?
Yes.
Okay.
When he brought CB in, I was coaching him to stop talking to him because he was, CB would have de-escalated if he had just stopped talking to him. So he did. And then once he was calm, then I talked with him and he said, no, he had not hit him. He had, was just blocking him so that he wouldn't spit on him.
Would you be able to describe the block that he would have used to prevent the spitting?
Well, what he explained to me, it was a long time ago, so I'm not totally clear, but he said it was a response block.
Okay. Do you have any idea what a response block would have been in that situation?
Well, what he described was that he put his hand out to keep him from coming any closer to spit.
Okay. Okay, so it was an attempt to reduce or to keep the distance between the staff member and CB,
right,
as far apart as he possibly
because
can.
He didn't,
with the,
yes.
Which could, okay,
have, which could have looked like a hit or a push from a distance.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, I just want to add that later, once the police came to the school and both of the people involved realized that it was going to be investigated by the police, the person who made the accusation then told me that he never said hit.
Okay.
So,
but that's not in the current documentation, correct?
Pardon me?
I believe that's correct. I believe that's correct, sir. This is Tricia.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Mickelson, just a question for the board staff. I know it wasn't expected that the police report would have been completed by today. Is that still accurate?
I believe Ms. Peterson requested a copy of the report directly to Phoenix Police Department. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that she has received it yet. Is that correct, Ms. Peterson?
That's correct.
Okay. And then also another question for board staff is, has there been any response from AP to this point?
There has not been.
Okay. Are there any other questions at this point from the committee members?
Dr. Sarnoff, Mr. Chair, there's no one else on the phone, correct? The complaint's not on the phone. There's no other parties except for Ms. Peterson and her lawyer, correct?
Dr. Davey, this is Jennifer, and that is correct. The complainant also was provided a notice of today's meeting, and he did not reach out to participate in any way.
Thank you.
Okay, so hearing there are no other questions, so the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, in this case licensees, or attorneys representing licensees. I'll begin the deliberation for this case as I'm the lead member. I want to start my deliberation by first addressing possible statute violations, and I hope that through discussion we can come to a consensus for this. But one statute that may align with the complaint is 32-2091.12, referring to unprofessional conduct. The board statute refers to unprofessional conduct, specifically an O, by providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities with behavior analysts that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And then possibly 32-2091.12 DD, violating an ethical standard adopted by the board. Arizona Revised Statute 13-3620.A, duty to report physical injury, and in A, any person who reasonably believes that a minor is or has been the victim of physical injury abuse, and in point A.4, including, it also includes school personnel. Relation to the code from the BACB, the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, code point 1.02, that all behavior analysts provide services, teach and conduct research only within the boundaries of their competence defined as being commensurate with their education, training, and supervised experience. And then in B of that same code, that they teach or conduct research in new areas of populations only after first undertaking appropriate study, training, supervision, and consultation from persons who are competent in those areas. So in relation with CB and other staff members, code point 1.04, that behavior analyst behavior conforms to the legal and ethical codes of the social and professional community of which they're members. And then if behavior analyst ethical responsibilities conflict with the law or any policy of an organization with which they're affiliated, behavior analysts may make known their commitment to this code and take steps to resolve the conflict in a responsible manner. And then 7.02, violations by others and risk of harm. If a behavior analyst believes there may be legal or ethical violation, they first determine whether there's potential for harm, a possible legal violation, a mandatory reporting condition, or an agency, organization, or regulatory requirement addressing the violation. And then B, if a client's legal rights are being violated or if there's potential for harm, behavior analysts must take necessary action to protect the client, including but not limited to contacting relevant authorities, following organizational policies, and consulting with appropriate professionals and documenting their efforts to address the matter. Those were the statutes that stood out to me that might be related to this case, but I want to have, obviously a discussion among ourselves about this, and if any other of the committee members have additional or questions about that, let's start talking about it.
Well, this is Dr. Davey. You know, I for one, am struggling through the information provided to, find something that rises to the level of a statute violation. Seeing that. I think this is something that could have been handled per BACB code by a behavior analyst talking to behavior analysts to see what the best steps would be in moving that forward. That is my opinion at this time.
This is Dr. Rateson, and I would agree with that. In reviewing all of the information, it seems that there were some other avenues to pursue here. But I would agree. I don't see anything at this point that would be at that level either.
And I had the same outcome as well. After reviewing the records, it appeared that there wasn't necessarily a code or a statute violation in this case. So is there any other further discussion from committee members?
Dr. Stenhoff, I'm ready to make a motion.
Okay. All right. Go ahead,
I'll make a motion that this complaint be closed as the committee has completed their work and found no violations.
I will second.
right. Is there any further discussion? All right, hearing no further discussion, I will call for the vote. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed, say nay. Okay, motion carries. So complaint number 20-32 regarding Ms. Peterson will be referred to the board with a recommendation to be dismissed this complaint.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Senna. All right, we will now move to agenda item number 6, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to the board pertaining to the approval of behavior analyst applicant. We will start with applicant Brandy Dufick, and Ms. I am Michael, the lead.
Ms. Michelson, yes. This is Tricia Schaefer. May Ms. Peterson and I leave the meeting?
Yes, thank you so much for participating, and I will be in touch.
Thanks to all of you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Rates, and I just want to let you know that for the first applicant, I am recused.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. So in summary, we reviewed Ms. Dufick's application at the last meeting, and we had several questions related to her application. The two main themes were, one, there were, because she wasn't present, we weren't able to ask any questions related to her answers to question number 12, which states that she has been under investigation or, I don't have it in front of me, or charged with a crime. And number 13, which discusses being sued by a previous employer. And so we requested that Ms. Dufick attend this meeting so that we could ask questions related to the matter directly. And then we also had one other question related to her supervisor reported that she did not observe the applicant every 2 weeks as required by the BACB standards. And so we requested additional documentation on the supervisor answering a no to number 4 of the supervision attestation. The supervisor has provided additional documentation, and that's available to the board. She stated that she was not able to consistently observe the applicant during the time that the applicant was under her supervision. So is Ms. Dufick on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. All right, then I will give a brief summary of the concerns that that arose from the last meeting. So on the application, we did receive an answer to number 12 regarding an incident in November of 2015 where you were involved in a disorderly conduct and an assault incident involving family members at a bar. It appears that it's been resolved through the completion of anger management classes. I think that there were quite a few different bits of information coming through on that one related to possible misinformation in the report and having to review video. And then the other answer was to number 13 regarding a previous employer in 2018 that had concerns regarding fraudulent activity and billing above and beyond authorized hours. There were additional concerns related to documentation and therapy notes. However, it appears that those claims did not move forward by the dismissal of the attorney's letter that states that there was no further information. So at this time, because we do have Ms. Dufick on the phone, I am going to ask if any board members have any questions for Ms. Dufick. All right, I do. I have a few. So regarding the incident in November, Ms. Dufick, it appears that this was an incident that involved alcohol. Can you just explain to the board now kind of your current use of alcohol, the lessons that were learned around the incident, and explain a little bit about the assault charge, because in the original report there was an assault charge, but it appears that that was not something that was founded. Can you kind of explain your perspective on that?
Sure. So I was never charged with assault. That was an error on police reporting, and you'll see that. I did submit other documents that showed that the only charge I was accused of was disorderly conduct, and that was dismissed. So it's interesting that the police report does say that I was charged with assault, but that's a clerical error that was cleared up. So what happened that evening is, you know, I was out with my family, and some friends, and, you know, we were enjoying ourselves and having some drinks at a bar. And our friend, our designated driver, was picking us up, and he's kind of a goofy guy, if I can say that. And the bouncer denied him entry. And so my sister went to investigate. And so my sister had a few drinks at this point and was talking to the bouncer outside about why they wouldn't let our designated driver come into the bar and gather us all up. And so at this point, the bouncer pushed my sister. My sister's a little person, and she ended up falling over and hitting her head on a glass window and falling to the floor. And so I kind of see this out of the corner of my eye, and so does her fiance, and so do the rest of everybody that was in our group. And so we all run to the door, and I believe Paul Garrett was physically violent. Nobody else in our group was. And so I just, you know, I was trying to push people off of my sister, and try and help her to her feet. And, the police were called, and then several different accounts were given to police officers. They never interviewed us, which was interesting. And, there was video surveillance of what had happened. And on video surveillance, it doesn't show my sister or I being violent at all. And so basically, you know, a crowd started to amass. This was when, police intervention can be a hot topic. And so, you know, the police decided to take all three of us to jail to sort of de-escalate the situation. And so that is what happened. I learned quite a bit from the situation. Absolutely, I need to be very careful, and so does everybody else, in terms of, leaving appropriately, and in terms of, like, visiting an establishment that serves alcohol, in terms of the bouncers and their perspectives and their responsibilities, to keep everybody safe. And, I recognize that now. And, for whatever reason, they had denied my sister re-entrance into the bar, and then also our designated driver, for some reason that was deemed unsafe. And so, we need to comply with those actions. And I regret it. I'm not sure that anything could have been done necessarily differently, other than, us just leaving the establishment and, going out with our designated driver and just, us gathering up everybody. I think that could have been handled a little bit differently. It's an embarrassment, and, I'm just really sorry. I wish that the state of Arizona had expungement, because there is evidence, video evidence, that, I was not violently involved at all in this incident. Again, I think it was just an attempt to separate the crowd. And, you know, later on, we discovered that one of the observers that gave a police report was an off-duty police officer who was nowhere near us, and so was really good friends with the bouncers at the time, and so I think there was some sort of collusion going on. Again, I'm just, you know, it's an embarrassment. I'm really sorry. I definitely think that we need to be more careful and follow the directives of the employees at the bar. I don't use alcohol often, hardly ever. So this isn't like a reoccurring issue or a problem. Did I answer all the questions?
Yeah, no, thank you. And I appreciate you being very thorough in your response. I'm going to shift gears a little bit to number 13, which is related to dynamic interventions and suspicion of fraudulent activity in billing. Can you clarify, were you a 1099 contractor or were you employed by them?
I was a 1099, but I was employed by them. I did sign like an employment contract.
So you were employed by them, not a 1099. The 1099 would be a contract that you were a consultant working on their behalf.
Yes. So I was a consultant working on their behalf. I guess
okay.
I just don't really know what the
No, that's okay. Yeah, and you would sign a contract either way. As a 1099, you would sign a contract mm-hmm. for your services as well. So that could be the confusion. It looks like there was more than one claim filed, and there's reference that a first claim was resolved, but there's not any information on how the first claim was resolved. I understand the other claims were kind of just went MIA, according to the attorney letters. But do you have any recollection of the first claim that was resolved and how it was resolved?
Yeah. So the first claim was Dynamic had claimed that I was I don't know the legal term, so sorry, but like basically defacement of their name. Page Unified School District was threatening or was saying that, you know, they don't want to use Dynamic's contracted speech services for the next year. And actually, Page never said that. Dynamic was projecting that they wouldn't be rehired for the next year of services due to the negative relationship that this incident might have caused. And so they were suing me for that contract amount. They did end up getting the contract next year, that following year for services. And so they dropped that.
Okay. And it states in here that there was some documentation discrepancy, billing that occurred when school was closed, and that the justification of that was that paperwork was being conducted, but that they're claiming that the notes and the documentation was subpar. What is kind of your understanding of their concerns related specifically to your documentation, what you've learned from that, and how you've changed your documentation method now?
So, I was using an ABA strategy, an ABA teaching methodology. These were some really severely impacted clients, students that needed, you know, functional communication training. And so I really think what happened is I went above and beyond what I was supposed to do as an SLPA, and I wrote individualized programming to really help support these kids and to use data-driven systems to help, you know, increase communication skills. And so the notes that I did turn in, they had graphs on them. They showed how many trials, how many trials I ran. They showed the different sort of communication opportunities I was using, so PRT. I submitted all of this documentation to them, And I think that they're just unfamiliar with it. So I had two SLP supervisors on site, and they were very familiar with PRT, pivotal response treatment, and, you know, the activities I was doing with the kids and how I was collecting data. And, you know, I actually did training with them and then also the teachers on how to, you know, implement this communication strategy in the classroom, and then, you know, spoke with parents about it. So this was like understood. And then, you know, dynamic, before they sued me, they requested to see all of my notes. So the owners of Dynamic requested to see everything. And so I sent them all of my therapy notes. And I think that they didn't understand what, you know, the data that I was taking. They didn't have direct training. Does that make sense? Like, yes. Everybody else did at the location, had direct training on what I was doing. You know, and I did write individualized programs for some of these students, some of the more severely impacted students. And so that did take more time. But again, you know, there was a clinical necessity. These children weren't learning in their natural environment. They weren't learning with structured teaching. And so I really wanted to help and to make, you know, having a behavior analysis background, I thought, great, I can actually help these kids. And so, you know, some of that programming does take extra time. You know, I created a picture exchange communication system for a student that had no functional communication and had lots of maladaptive behaviors related to not being able to communicate his wants and his needs. And so I just put a lot of time and a lot of work. I will say that, you know, there were some clerical errors on my part. I was working, you know, part-time with Dynamic. I was working full-time with another behavioral company, and I was in grad school. And so there was a lot going on. And I, you know, I definitely did get dates mixed up and, you know, made some clerical errors, as Dynamic, you know, did as well. And, you know, I've learned that I absolutely need accurate documentation. You know, it's so important. And, you know, that's one of my, like, personal struggles. I have, like, a self-management program going for myself. But, you know, making sure that my documentation is accurate and it's done immediately. And that's one of the things that I had trouble with. I was driving 3 hours from Flagstaff to Page to start services. And then I'd have, you know, anywhere from an 8 to 12 hour day. And then I was driving home and then trying to do notes once I got home. And so it was just, again, a lot on my plate.
I have a couple of other questions. Are you currently still an SLPA, or did you let that last?
I let that expire.
Okay. And so they didn't, based on the attorney letters, it looks like they didn't actually pursue any of the charges or the claims. Did they file a complaint with the Speech and Language Pathology Board at all?
No, they didn't.
Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that there were some discrepancies, too, in terms of billing. So an SLPA had left mid-school year, and my supervisor had texted me and asked me if I could pick up those extra hours and come down another day to Page. And so thinking that she's my direct supervisor, that she's okayed this with the directors, I said, absolutely. So I had, and this employee had been gone for a month, so there were compensatory services that needed to be made up. And so, you know, the directors of Dynamic and the billing department noticed that I had been billing an extra day 6 months after I'd been doing it, and said, oh, this isn't in our contract. We just, you know, we signed up for one day, basically. And Paige used that sort of against me. You know, I submitted emails to the board saying that they would just pay me for the extra day. And actually the FBA that they asked me to write through their contract dynamic. And I had no idea that that was a predetermined contract. You know, I just didn't go through the proper chains. I should have verified with the directors that this was okay. Instead of my on-site supervisors, you know, I should have verified. And so there was, you know, a discrepancy there, but it was just a lack of communication and a lack of understanding. And, you know, unfortunately, Dynamic got footed with the bill and were trying to say that they didn't agree to those extra hours for me to do and didn't want to pay me for it.
So, thank you. All right. That's all the questions that I have related to that matter. I am going to ask a question related to then your supervisor, Ms. Filas, who answered no to one of the questions related to observing you as the applicant every 2 weeks. Do you recall, do you have documentation related to the frequency at which she did observe you?
We met every 2 weeks in person. Yes, I do have.
Okay, but did she observe you in your natural environment working every 2 weeks? Okay.
No, we met every 2 weeks. But she, you know, we tried to conduct direct observations together. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why both of us left this company. You know, it was just was, they were not moving towards an ABA, model, and so we both decided that we needed to leave and work for, you know, more reputable companies, one more aligned with the BACB guidelines.
Okay. All right. Those are all the questions I have. Are there any other questions that the board members have? All right. Hearing none, Ms. Dufick, thank you so much for answering my questions. The board will now the committee will now discuss your application, and again, we appreciate your time. I will go ahead, since I am the lead for the committee, I'll go ahead and kind of start the deliberation on this particular application. I'm satisfied with the response that has been received regarding the disorderly conduct incident. I'm satisfied with the response that's been received regarding the contract issue, the fraudulent billing documentation. I will note that this is a common issue that we see with 1099 contracts, which is one of the reasons why our field really is pursuing encouraging people against the 1099 contract, because this is something that it's just a little bit of uncharted waters, and there's some legal implications to the employment process that happens with that, and so I'm satisfied with that. I do have one concern, and it's related to the rule and our requirements for supervision, and that is specific to the requirements that the supervisee be observed in their natural environment conducting behavior analysis. And that is actually a BACB requirement that unfortunately I'm not sure meets the BACB requirements either. And so I would like for the committee to maybe discuss where we go from here, because I'm concerned that the BACB has one doesn't have the mechanisms to catch this. Two, concerned that we don't have the documentation that meets the rules for the observation in the natural environment. And I'm not quite sure. It's a substantial amount of hours. It's about 900 of the 1,500 hours. So it's a substantial amount of hours. And I would welcome kind of committee members' input on where to go with this. Ms. Michelson, do we have Ms. Galvin here?
Yes, she is on the line.
Here.
Okay.
I thought you were looking for input from the committee.
Oh, I am. I was just, since it was quiet, okay. I was plotting and planning my next direction.
Okay.
So I don't know if committee members have any thoughts or input. Can we confirm that the committee members are still on the line?
Confirmed.
Excellent. Well, we've got one. Ms. Rates is recused, so that just leaves Dr. Senhoff and Dr. Davey.
I'm listening. I mean, I think you summarized pretty much the issue, so I'm not sure exactly what the ask is at this point.
Yeah, I'm looking to see, I mean, I'm reviewing the rule to see if the current rules by chance allow for any, I know what the BACB requirements are, and I'm not sure if then we, it's unfortunate.
What rule are you looking at? Davis Wilson.
I am reviewing the supervision standards. Let's see, it's R426-404.2 supervised experience requirement.
Okay.
And I'm reviewing it now. The way that the BACB has it now is it's no longer every 2 weeks. It used to be at the time of supervision, it used to be that the supervisor had to observe the individual at least once every two-week period in their natural environment performing ABA services, that a simple meeting with the supervisor was not sufficient. That language has been changed now to be twice in a 30-day period, so it doesn't have to be as prescriptive as every 2 weeks. But I'm looking to see if that same language was copied over into our rule.
The rule in the same statute, B, where's it at? B2D states be supervised at the frequency that meets the standard of the BACB at the time of supervision.
Yeah. Okay.
And then also it's repeated in 3D as well.
Yep, I see.
Oh, that's for intent. That's intensive practicum, excuse me. So just regular practicum is 2D, yeah.
Yeah. So
either way, I don't believe this applicant was observed in the natural environment, correct?
Right, correct.
Whether
correct.
I was observed as much as possible in the natural environment. Like we'd go through assessment, indirect, indirect, and results, and we'd review my FBAs together, next steps, and things like that. What we do have documented is our 2 week meetings. Where we met face-to-face and did things like that. But we did meet in the natural environment, just not consistently, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Dufick. I appreciate that clarification. I think the concern is that the BACB has that prescribed in the supervision requirement as to how frequently it does have to happen. And I think that's the point that we're looking at is that there was not, that at the time of supervision, so where it says be supervised at a frequency that meets the standard of the BACB at the time of supervision, that standard during that time was once every 2 weeks. In the natural environment, that was not just referring to meetings.
Ms. Dufick, I've got a question. Do you think it's possible to would your current records indicate the extent to which you're observed in the natural environment? Or the frequency, if framing it up a little different.
It might be possible. I would have to look back and see if I could get records, scheduling records with myself and Katrine, but we definitely did a lot of, natural, a lot of shadowing and a lot of, ABA together. It really depends upon the company and if we're able to sort of pull up those, previous calendars. I don't know if that's possible, but it might be worthwhile.
Thank you.
Dr. Stenhoff, are you also referring to potentially post-supervised experience? So, Ms. Dufick, one of the things that we have the option to look at is your supervision that has occurred to kind of make up some of those hours. We have at this point a supervisor who's saying, no, I did not observe her on a 2-week basis. We could look at, well, then how many hours, if that supervisor was able to go back through the records and say, yes, I observed on these dates and here's the proof of it, then some of those weeks could potentially count. And then I'm wondering if there's additional weeks beyond certification in which observations have occurred at the place of employment now that maybe there's documentation that could count to make up for whatever hours wouldn't. But I think, Dr. Stenhoff, I think that would be probably the next piece is to, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding, but to potentially see how many of those 900 hours truly are affected by that standard and see how, which 2-week periods there was an observation versus which 2 weeks there were not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the direction I was going.
Okay. So I would be in support of that if, as a committee, we want to move forward with a request for additional supervision documentation, specifically which of the 2 weeks through the course of supervision an observation did occur, and so that we can look at how many hours are truly affected by this and then take action however we need once we have that additional information.
Madam Chair, the only question I would ask, and maybe this is a Gene Galvin one, is the individual is certified by the ACB, and so does that have any bearing on us continuing to kind of go down this path? And it's more of a question than it is any sort of statement.
That I don't know.
Ms. Galvin, Dr. Davey, I had a similar thought, and I think that would be a potential of our obligation to notify the BACB of this information. But I would like, if that were something that we needed to do, which I that was one of the first thoughts that came to my mind, was that we probably would need to notify the BACB of our findings. I would still want that additional information to make sure that we're clear as to truly how many hours are being affected here.
Kathy, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
So I don't know if Dr. Davies' question was that because she is a BCA already, do we have the authority or do we look at the underlying, supervision requirements? Or is it like with a program that's APA approved, we just accept what they were engaged in as far as training and education as satisfying our requirements?
My understanding is the fact that someone is BCBA certified has no bearing on our licensure requirements. The only requirement that we have is that they pass the exam for certification, not that they are certified.
Okay, thank you. But Dr. Davis-Wilson, you're wondering if the board or the committee has an obligation to notify the federal agency or national agency of perhaps the shortcomings in supervision.
Yes, I believe that that is the question that's being asked.
I think once if you have additional documentation that you want to review to try to see if we can't establish the hours that maybe occurred after this initial supervision, then whether to notify the National Association would be something we could look at a later time.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Galvin. Dr. Davey, does that satisfy kind of your yeah. inquiry as well?
Yeah, I was just interested. Like, I know we accept some of the documentation now, and so I just wanted to hear that. Discussion. I fully appreciate everything you said.
Thank you. Then I'm going to go ahead and make a motion that we go ahead and move forward with a request for additional information. The information that we would be requesting is additional supervision documentation specific to the every 2 weeks. Notes, the supervision forms, and then any indication of which of those 2 weeks involved a direct observation, and which ones did not. And I think that, Ms. Folks, I don't know if in theory, both the supervisor and the supervisee should have all of their supervision records. And so I don't know who we would direct that to, but I would be okay with them working together to come to a consensus. I think whatever that consensus is, we do need the supervisor to, since the supervisor is the one saying, nope, I did not observe her consistently, I think we need the supervisor to attest to which 2 week periods she did observe her and which ones she did not.
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. I'll make sure that that's in the letter, that the information must come from the supervisor directly to the board.
And that was a motion probably out of turn, but do we have a second for the motion?
Dr. Davy, I'll second that motion.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Right, the motion carries. Ms. Dufek, we will be in contact. We will send a letter to you regarding the additional information that we need from your supervisor. And again, we're looking for, you know, just trying to figure out which of those 2 week periods would count so that we can see the impact of the total supervision. And you can contact board staff if you have any questions related to the documentation that you're looking for, and board staff will relay those to us as needed.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for being here today. We appreciate it. All right. I'm going to move to agenda number 6-2, Caitlin Welty. Dr. Rates, can you provide us?
May I interrupt? Oh, this is Kathy. Dr. Davis-Wilson, yes. I apologize. I don't think you were on the line. Ms. Brown Shipley is also present on the line for her application. You had wanted to do a personal interview with her.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and do that then. Let's move to Ms. Brown Shipley. Let me switch my notes because I am the lead on this one as well. 1 second. All right. We reviewed Ms. Brown Shipley's application at a previous board meeting and noted that she did answer yes to number 12, having been convicted of a misdemeanor or felony. She did provide a letter explaining the circumstances of that information. However, there were some discrepancies in the letters. And so as the lead, I did request that Ms. Brown Shipley be in attendance for today so that we could ask her questions related to her application. Ms. Brown Shipley, are you on the phone?
I am.
Excellent. Are there any questions from the board members? I will go ahead and begin. So my first question is going to be related to just the event in general. Can you walk us through kind of the account of what happened on the night that you were arrested for the DUI?
Sure. So I guess to start, I lived in a rural area outside of Erie, Pennsylvania, which is a small city in Pennsylvania. And earlier in the day, I had driven, so I lived about 20 miles outside of that town. And I had driven earlier in the day into town to drop my daughter off at her father's house. The weather was pretty bad and visibility was super low at the time. My car had been a sports car, a two-door sports car. It was pretty bad in the snow, and this day particularly, it was really, really bad outside. The roads were covered in ice and snow. So I wasn't really getting traction in my car. Had difficulty getting up a couple of hills, that sort of thing. So after I dropped my daughter off, I called a friend and pulled my car over to the side of the road, and he came and picked me up. And this is a friend that I was going to be spending some time with afterwards. So we had parked my car, and I rode with him in his four-wheel drive truck. We had went back to his house, and we were preparing to go shopping, to dinner, and do a couple things around the mall area, including going out for drinks afterwards. So we had went back to his house, as I said, and then we got in a cab and we went to the mall. We roamed the mall, went and had dinner, went to a movie, and then in that same area had a couple drinks, both at dinner and then afterwards. After several hours of just hanging out with friends, we were all leaving the establishment. Some of us went one way, others went the other way. I had left specifically with the friend who I had intended on staying with that evening. We left in a cab. Some point along the way between the establishment and getting back to his house, I had redirected the cab back to my car. That kind of stemmed just from my uncomfortability in staying with him after having many drinks and just not really feeling safe in general. So I had the cab with my friend drop me off back at my car. At that time, when I got to my car, I believe, and you know, to be completely honest, I believe my intention when I got back to my car was to drive home. I was uncomfortable and I wanted to go home. After assessing the situation when I got to my car, I had recognized that I was not capable of driving. It was not a safe idea. The road conditions were bad. I had been drinking and I lived pretty far away. At that point, I decided to just go to sleep in my car. I was awoken by a man pulling me out of my car, which is when the police were called.
Thank you. That does help me with some of the discrepancies between the couple of the letters. It looks like one letter was kind of shorter. The other one provided additional information. I am still trying to seek clarification around some of the discrepancies. So can you tell me where your car was parked?
My car was parked on the side of a two-lane highway.
Okay. And I have in here that that in at one point you say that you knew it was unsafe to drive, so you opted not to. And at another you say that you should not have made the decision to drive. So I'm just seeking clarification. Did you get to your car, not drive, or did you drive?
No, I got to my car and knew that I shouldn't be driving and chose not to drive.
And so you stayed on the side of the highway?
Correct.
Where your car was originally parked?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. In the police report, it mentioned that the car was stopped in a travel lane. Do you think perhaps prior to the witness moving the car that maybe you made an attempt to drive?
No, I don't believe so. When the witness had found me sleeping in my car, the car was in park and the engine was off. So it, falling asleep while driving was not a possibility due to the car being parked and the keys being turned in the off position. Additionally, you know, when I had pulled the car over earlier in the day, there was no real way to tell where the travel lane and the shoulder met, outside of previous car tracks that had went down the snowy road. I had did my best to pull the car over. However, there's multiple feet of snow on the shoulder itself, in addition to not being able to see the travel lane and where the travel lane and the shoulder truly met. I just did my best to pull the car over as far over onto the shoulder as I could.
Okay. And during the time that you were out with friends and hanging out with this individual, shopping, going to dinner, doing all of these things, at no point anybody had any concerns of your vehicle already being partially in the travel lane? Appears not.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the car was pulled over to the best of our ability, and at the time, I was more concerned with driving that car in the snow and those conditions than leaving it parked on the side of the road.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from committee members? I was just trying to get a clarification on some of the inconsistencies. Does anybody else have any
questions? If I can say something, Dr. Davis?
Yes. Absolutely.
I just want to be really clear that by detailing the events that led up to the DUI charge, like, I'm not trying to shirk responsibility or diminish my culpability in the charge itself. Fact of the matter is I was in a motor vehicle in the driver's seat intoxicated with my keys, and that alone is a valid DUI charge. So I just wanted to be clear that, like, just by telling what led up to it, I fully accepted responsibility for my actions and choices that led to that.
And what is your current use of alcohol at this time?
I do not currently use alcohol. I previously did not feel that I drank a lot or frequently. However, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and this event led me to decide that I wanted nothing to do with alcohol ever again.
Thank you. Do any committee members have any questions for Ms. Brown?
No, this is Dr. Davey. I would just say I just would thank her for her honesty and willingness to come and speak to us so that we could have a better understanding of the situation. And so I know it's not probably a fun thing to revisit, but appreciate your professional and your willingness. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Anybody else? Yeah, and I'm going to echo what Dr. Davey said, because I do think that hearing kind of your account helped put together the we had two letters from you plus the police report, and putting all the pieces together helped resolve any of the concerns that I had. I can imagine a nerve-wracking process to have to sit and kind of relive and go through this again, especially when it looks like you've done a lot. You've relocated to a new state. You're looking at, getting licensed to practice. And so I too appreciate your time. I'm going to turn it over to the committee for review. Ms. Brown Shipley, she passed her exam in November of 2019 and graduated from the Chicago's
school's ABA program in August of 2019. She was supervised from January 2018 to March of 2019 here in Arizona with a licensed behavior analyst for over 1,500 hours. I believe she's provided us sufficient documentation related to the answer number 12, and I have no further concerns, so I would move, or I would recommend this to the full board for approval. Thank you, Ms. Brown-Shipley, for joining us. We appreciate you being on the call, and board staff will be in touch with you after the full board reviews your application.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, we are going to move on to number six, Caitlin Welty. Dr. Rates, can you provide us an overview of this application?
Yes. So Ms. Welty received her BCBA in February of this year. She indicated on her application that she is also licensed as a special education teacher. She completed her master's in special education at the U of A and graduated in December of 19. All of her supervision took place at United Cerebral Palsy of Southern Arizona for a total of 1,988 hours, and that was all done under the supervision of Regina Mandler. I hope I said that correctly. In reviewing her application, I didn't have any questions or concerns, and would recommend that this be moved forward to the board.
Excellent. Do any committee members have any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move on to number three, Elizabeth Jordan. Dr. Stenhoff, can you please provide us an overview of this application?
Yeah. Ms. Jordan graduated with her Master of Arts in Clinical Psychology from Cal State Dominguez Hills and completed her certificate in Behavioral Interventions and Autism at UMass Lowell in 2014. She received 1,578 hours of supervision under several supervisors in the state of California and obtained her BCBA in November of 2014. I didn't note any concerns with this application. Recommend it be forwarded to the board for approval.
Excellent. Do any committee members have any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move on to number four, Gina Mastriani. Dr. Stenhoff, you are also the lead on this application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Ms. Mastriani, with her Master of Education and Curriculum Instruction from Arizona State University, in 2019, she received 1,547.5 hours under the supervision of Taryn Snyder. I do not have any concerns with this application and recommend that it be forwarded to the board for approval.
Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. Do any committee members have any questions or comments regarding this application? Hearing none, we will move on to number five, Julie Tyma. Dr. Davey, you are the lead on this application. Can you provide us an overview?
Madam Chair. This is Dr. Rates. I just want to indicate that we do work for the same agency, but we have had no significant contact, so I feel like I can move forward objectively.
Thank you, Dr. Rates.
All right, thank you, everyone. In reviewing the application for Julie, Tyma noted that she is a graduate of the University of West Florida, where she earned her MA in applied behavior analysis. Also within the teacher education leadership program. Her application was completed. She did her supervision work with Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center. She was supervised by Hannah Rowe. Hannah Rowe is a licensed analyst in good standing in the state of Arizona. Found no concerns with this application and moved to have it go forward.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Are there any committee members with any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move on to number six, Cassandra Montillo. I am the lead on this application. Cassandra is seeking initial licensure. She graduated from ASU's Master's of Education in Curriculum and Instruction ABA program online in May of 2018. She completed supervision between the periods of January of 2017 through July of 2018. She was supervised here in Arizona across four different licensed supervisors for just over 1,500 hours. I noted that there was a couple of what looks like might be clerical, and I don't know if Ms. Folks, you have any explanation, but it looks like on page number one, she does not indicate that she is certified for question number six. However, she does for question number seven state that she took the exam in November of 2019. We do have verification from the BACB that she is indeed certified. So I don't know if there was any additional information or if this is just something that Ms. Folks, you can reach out to her and get corrected.
Dr. Davis Wilson, committee members, I do believe that I got this corrected, and I think I put the wrong application page into the file. So if you want to move on, I'll see if that got scanned properly and send you the correct one.
Perfect.
That was my entire that to her.
Perfect. Yeah, I figured it was something clerical, and because of that, my recommendation was just going to be to have you correct that prior to it going to full board. But if that's been resolved, then that's great. I do also, and I noted this, and it's probably it probably from a statute perspective isn't a big deal. However, page number six, question number one regarding her experience, it shows that her experience ended in July of 2018, which shows that she's potentially been out of working for almost 2 years. I just wanted to note that. I'm not sure if we can request additional information regarding current work experience from 2018 to current, or if it's, you know, people have babies and, you know, do their own thing, and she's met all the other requirements. So if no other committee members have any concerns, then I have no problem letting that one go either. Other than that, then my recommendation would just be to get that first page corrected. Are there any questions or concerns from the committee members? All right, excellent. Hearing none, then we're going to go to number seven, and that's going to be Krisha Agata. Dr. Stenhoff, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Yeah, Ms. Agata graduated with her Master of Arts in Applied Behavior Analysis from Ball State University in 2016. She received 1,619 hours of supervision under Natasha Dick, who's a licensed behavior analyst in the state of New York, where she received her supervision. She was a BCBA as of November of 2018. I don't have any concerns, and would recommend this before to the board for approval.
Excellent. Do we have any questions or concerns from any committee members? Hearing none, I'm going to move to number eight, Mara Gayton. Dr. Davey, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mara Gayton graduated from Arizona State University. Sorry, my screen decided to freeze right as I was getting ready to pull this through. There we go. Arizona State University, Master of Education, Curriculum Instruction. She also studied at the University of Southern California for Master's in Social Work. She completed the application in its entirety. Of note, as going through the application the first time, reached back out to board staff, who was great as always. They were able to pull us some additional information on the supervisor to ensure that both Ashley Horton, who was a LBA in the state of Arizona, was in good standing during the time that she provided supervision, as well as the other supervisor, Melissa Sue Mallon. And then in completing the review, found no issues with it and would be happy to see this one move forward.
Excellent. Do any committee members have any questions or concerns? Hearing none, we will move on to Megan Sullivan. I am the lead on this one. I do have one small disclosure, and that is that Megan began employment towards the end of my employment with her supervision site. So I was not involved in her supervision or any aspect of her employment. So I am comfortable moving forward with this review. Megan passed her exam in February of 2020. She took her master's through ASU, Master's of Education, Curriculum, and Instruction. She completed her supervision across four licensed supervisors from the periods of November of 2017 to December of 2019 for just over 1,500 hours. After review of this application, I do not have any concerns and would recommend this be forwarded to the full board for approval. Do any committee members have any questions or concerns? Hearing none, we will go on to number 11, Patricia Egan. Dr. Rates, you are the lead on this applicant. Can you please provide us an overview?
Yes, thank you. So Ms. Egan completed her master's in education at ASU in their online curriculum and instruction program between fall of 2016 and May of 2018. She received her supervision for a total of 1,740 hours at Inspira Behavior and Advocacy Specialists between January of 17 and January of 18, all under Elizabeth Sequeira. All of this did take place in California, which was not a state that had licensure at the time. In reviewing the application, I did not have any questions and would recommend that this be moved forward.
Excellent, thank you. That concludes the review of all of the applications. Do we have a motion?
This is Kathy. Madam Chair and committee members, I emailed you the copy of the page that Ms. Montijo sent to correct those questions that you noticed. If you want to look at it, and finish that one, please feel free.
Okay. Just 1 second to go to. Perfect. That is corrected, so I would recommend that her application be forwarded to the full board. All right. Do we have a motion on the application? I will go ahead and provide a summary. Actually, I'll just make the motion. I'm going to motion that we forward applicants Caitlin Welty, Elizabeth Jordan, Gina Mastriani, Julie Tymon, Cassandra Monteo, Krisha Agatep, Mara Gayton, Megan Sullivan, Morgan Brown Shipley, and Patricia Egan to the full board for review and recommendation for approval. We did already motion on Ms. Dufek and her request for additional information.
I will second.
Do we have a second? Excellent. We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. All right. And we will now move to item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding continuation of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners and proposed legislation, including but not limited to SB 1054, HB 2224, HB 2184, HB 2288, HB 2809, SB 1211, SB 1212, and SB 1507. And I'm sure there's quite an update with all of the stuff going on, or the lack thereof, I should say. So is Ms. Packnett on the phone?
I am, Madam Chair, and yes, that is that's an apt description. 1 week ago today, Monday the 23rd, the legislature finished their work on a series of bills that they determined were necessary to get to the governor's office in preparation for a recess of at least 3 weeks. Fortunately, the 58 bills that they were able to pass before the recess. One of those bills was the most important one, Senate Bill 1054, which continues this agency for an additional 8 years. The other bills listed on the agenda and others as well that I've included in the tracking reports, they remain in some state of suspension, I'm describing it, because what we don't know is when the legislature will reconvene, will come back from recess to finish its work, or quite frankly, whether they do. If the legislature doesn't return, then we have, I think, some issues to address with respect to House Bill 2224. If you remember, that was the bill that implemented the fingerprint card clearance. It made some VA supervision revisions that are time sensitive, and it also created a short-term accommodation for former students in the psychology program of the now closed Argosy University. So, you know, time was of concern, you know, with respect to that bill. So if it isn't allowed to move forward because the legislature doesn't address it, we'll have to discuss that at this time or at that time. Some of the other bills that we were tracking would have imposed some changes with respect to universal recognition, the board's collection of fees. Again, those are uncertain. Their fate is uncertain. What complicates this issue, of course, there's the public health issue, which is overriding all of this. But naturally, the members of the legislature are getting pressure from their constituents and from stakeholder groups that they would want the legislature to finish their work and, you know, pass the bills that had were progressing well and were likely to pass had the recess not been scheduled. But the longer that the legislature is faced with the proposition of a lengthy recess, the appetite to reconvene may be diminished because it is an election year. So all of those factors are swirling around in this great unknown, and the best that I can do is to try to collect facts and relay those to this committee and to the board so we can determine where we go from that point in time. Does anyone have any questions about this?
I have so many questions, but they're probably not appropriate for this view. No, but that was a great review, and thank you for letting us know kind of where we stand during this period. And I think we can all appreciate that this is, just truly an event that is forcing us to kind of look at the way we're operating and how the legislature is going to work through these things, given the fact that they are essentially dismissed at this point. So thank you for keeping us updated.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Hearing none, we will move on to number 8, discussion consideration possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Pakanon, can you provide us a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm happy to. And I'm not certain this is something that has been historically provided to you, but because we are the recipient, I'm the recipient of several updates, frequent updates from the BACB that have a regulatory focus. What I'm electing to do is just simply provide those to you so you have that information. If it's duplicative, you know, I regret that maybe you're getting more emails or more materials than is absolutely necessary. But what I think is helpful, I'd love your feedback to this. I think it's helpful to provide you with regulatory focused information from BACB and to have a standing item on the agenda so you have opportunity to discuss it, provide me or staff with some direction, make policy recommendations relative to the information coming from the BACB, and so forth. So I would love your feedback and reaction to this approach.
Ms. Pakanan, thank you. And I'll go ahead and start it off with saying that I do think that this would be extremely helpful. There is a lot going on. And as behavior analysts, we also oftentimes get those updates through our portal, the newsletters and what have you. But I think that sometimes we get a little bit late to the game. Well, I shouldn't say we're late to the game. It's sometimes with everything else going on, hard to digest. Like, is this something that needs to be a committee matter or not? And I think that if they're just consistently presented to us and we can say, hey, this was just informative, thank you, we're all aware and we all confirm that we're aware, great. But if it does require action, especially given the amount of time that it takes to process rule changes and legislative changes, that I think that having just a standing spot of here are the updates, here's what we have going on, so we can talk about implications, I personally would find helpful. But committee members, I open it to you guys for comments and questions as well.
I would just echo what you said, Dr. Davis Wilson. I do find it helpful, and I think it sometimes, you know, I will read the update from the BACB, and maybe I'm reading it more as a clinician and not as a member of this committee. And so I do think it's helpful that those are pushed back at us for further review, given our goals. So I, for one, welcome the information.
Excellent, Dr. Raitson. I would agree.
Oh, terrific. I'm sorry. I just wanted to also chime in with an assurance that over time, as I become more astute about BACB developments that have, you know, a regulatory impact, I will sort of, you know, synthesize this information for you, present you with some considerations or some possible outcomes, outline the implications. So going forward, you know, I hope to be to analyze this information more effectively for your consideration. You know, at a minimum, this information is being supplied as an FYI, but I hope over time, you know, I'm able to prepare something that is, you know, really more thoughtful for you to consider.
Thank you, Ms. Peckman. All right, any other questions or comments? Hearing none, I'm going to move to agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding recommendations to the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners for Behavior Analyst Rule Revisions. Ms. Packnum, this is you again.
Yes, so just a little bit of background for this agenda item. You may remember that this was on your agenda earlier this month, and it was an item that you elected to postpone discussing until this meeting. We do have, of course, a rule package that is weeks away from review by the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. I think that day is May 5th, it's early May, that set of rule changes that you last drafted, that would be considered on May 5th for purposes of review, and then it becomes effective 45 days after filing in the Arizona Administrative Register. So we're looking at probably a date in July when those rules are in effect. In the meantime, a couple of issues have been raised, some rule changes that may have been previously considered and didn't make it into the rule package, or an idea, one idea I think has emerged very recently. And they relate to one that allows for, I think it's asynchronous supervision of behavior analyst applicants. And then the other suggestion was a recommendation that members of this committee who are participate obviously in these meetings earn continuing education credit. So it's sort of a parity with as psychologists serving on the Board of Psychologist Examiners are eligible to earn a certain amount of CE credit, that opportunity would to be extended to members of the CBA. So those are the two suggestions that have come my way. If there are other recommendations that this committee would like to pursue, this is the time to maybe start talking about it, assembling these, and deciding at what point do we actually propose another rulemaking package.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Peckman. Committee members, do you have any questions?
Not at this time.
And I would just like to thank Ms. Peckman. It appears that that there may have been some oversight between what we had recommended, what we had reviewed and saw and added versus what actually went before the rulemaking process. And we're not quite sure. There was a lot of things going on, so we're not quite sure where that was. But I appreciate Ms. Peckman for staying on top of kind of those areas. And I will encourage you guys to really look at the updates closely, because some of the little typos that we've caught were actually caught by Dr. Davidson, who is very, 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 very detail-oriented. And so hopefully we can do that justice in picking up on kind of that detail orientation so that we can continue to move forward with that. I don't know, Ms. Peckman, I'm guessing the rule writing process is of low priority for the governor's office as well. So we'll just work through this process and then discuss at a later time the revisions that we need.
I would agree with that assumption. I know that the reports we're getting from the governor's office staff is that it's all hands on deck right now dealing with the public health crisis that they're trying to manage. So I think that we can expect things like term appointments are taking a back seat, rule package reviews and approvals. As you know, there's still a rulemaking moratorium effectively in place. And so we would have to present any proposed rule changes to the governor's office for review and approval. In the best of circumstances, that takes weeks or months. So I would not, I don't want to suggest that we could be looking at some pushing some new rules into effect in the coming 12 months. I don't think that that's a realistic expectation. If this committee and the board, if you decide there are some very critical rules that need to be addressed, of course, you know, we'll move forward with that. So I think really your challenge is to ascertain how critical are certain proposed changes relative to everything else that's going on. So, and that's really up for you to decide.
Okay. Excellent. Any other questions or concerns from committee members? Hearing none, we will move on to agenda item 10, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations for the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners concerning ARS 32-2091.15. Ms. Peckman, there is not anybody listed here. Is there?
I did keep this on the agenda just for purposes of if you know you wanted to have this discussion today, you can certainly direct it to be on an agenda in the coming months. Acknowledging, of course, what I mentioned earlier, which is the legislature is on recess of an undetermined duration. If and when they do resume their work, it would be too late to try to pick up and make any changes to the statute on a striker bill, for instance. It depends on how soon you really want to have this kind of a conversation for purposes of possible legislation in 2021. So if you want this agenda item to sort of come back, you know, late summer, early fall, which is, you know, I think a reasonable time frame to revisit it, that's great. Or you can have a discussion now, and I'll hold on to this material until it's time to look for a sponsor.
Thank you.
board staff, members of the committee, I'm going to do a very brief overview of what this entails because I believe Dr. Davey was absent at the last meeting, and then I'm happy to provide commentary on what I think we should do with it next. But just as a brief overview, I brought this specific statute to the concern of the committee. Because in light of some of the things that we have learned on the full board, one of the if you recall, when we were setting up this committee, there was a steering committee that had a lot of concerns around kind of the behavior analyst representation and how do we ensure that the board was not using authority above and beyond what was necessary to protect the public. There's a lot of history between the behavior analyst and the psychologist, especially early on in developing the statute for behavior analyst licensure. I apologize for the crying in the background. Welcome to children being home till the end of the school year. Anyway, we have the statute that was added to add the committee on behavior analysts, and that was done largely with the same steering committee that had the same experience at the onset of the development of behavior analyst licensure. And there were quite a few key points that were discussed with that, and Dr. Davey, I'm sure you will recall them, specific to, again, ensuring that there's representation from the actual behavior analysis community as far as guiding some of the regulatory practices. And so since then, we have been able to be a committee for a few years now. I think we're on, our third year? I've already started to leak out. I think we're on our third year now. And I think there's a lot that, especially at the board level, that we've learned that I think impacts this specific statute. And some of those things are specific to the terms. And so I did present a concern with a committee member may not serve more than two full consecutive terms. And the reason why I bring that up has nothing to do with behavior analysts, but on the psychology side, what we're finding is that we're having quorum issues. We're having issues with people not wanting to, I shouldn't say they don't want to, but there's not a ton of applicants for this type of work. It's a lot of response for very low incentives, and a lot of behavior analysts as a young field are still working. So it's not like some of the other boards that establish, through individuals that are later in their careers or retiring or able to, to juggle both. We have a very young field. And so I'm concerned with that restriction, seeing that on the psychology board we have several people who have served multiple terms or who are still kind of as placeholders for terms because there hasn't been anybody to take their place. And so I'm concerned about that language and the restrictions that might put on board and the board staff and our ability to meet that statute with that being there. The other questions that I had around that is related kind of to the tenure of what happened. So if you've got the committee the committee on behavior analysis, and then you've got two of the committee members that are appointed to the board, and so which of the time frames do we look at? We know we've got the 5-year appointment, but if board members are needed and needed to continue, then do we still look at that two full consecutive terms? The other thing that I want to bring up is that, this, as you guys are aware, this has been a lot of work, and especially at the board level. So you've got the committee level where, you take even today's agenda, and there was a lot of stuff to review, a lot of applications. Some of those applications had multiple documents. You can times that tenfold for the board position. And so my concern is being able to retain people that by the time you even learn what the regulatory process is about, and you get past that part, then you've got, tens of thousands of pages that you're reading every month, that I'm concerned that restriction is going to be difficult. We're going to see people having to step down from their appointments, as we have recently seen. Now,
while that's not, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal in the big picture of things, what's happening is that as people are stepping down or not renewing their position, we're having quorum issues at the board level. And what that's doing is it's delaying complaints. It's delaying people's ability to get licensed because we don't have a quorum to move them forward. And so, so I brought those pieces forward at the last meeting to just say, like, hey, now that we have behavior analysts that are in the trenches of what being on the board means, maybe we need to have consideration and conversation with the stakeholders of some possible revisions to that. The other piece that I brought up was in Section E, and we did discuss this at length, is that really Section E is something that kind of puts our responsibility back to our stakeholders, which I think is fine. However, the concern that I presented is that we were not having stakeholder participation reciprocated back. And so essentially what Section E is saying is that outside of just licensure, and complaints, if we're going to be making any type of recommendations to the full board, that we as a committee would have to seek stakeholder input before we make those recommendations. So when we say, hey, we think rule writing should be like this, so before it goes to the full board, we need AZIABA and member, you know, and licensees and whoever to have, you know, adequate access to being involved in those conversations. And my concern around that is that a couple of things. One, as far as timelines go, sometimes we don't have time to seek that input, and we're still seeking that input at different stages. We invite them to the meetings. We encourage them to follow the agendas. We have public commenting periods. So once it goes to the full board, if it is anything that's going to move forward like rule revisions, there's public commenting periods. So those things are still happening. But I feel like this wording is a little bit limiting as far as meeting those timelines. And I think that it continues for me to be problematic that the stakeholders aren't coming to the table. So it's kind of, we can't even implement this exact statute because they're not coming to the table. Anyway, that is my overview of why I brought this forth as a potential concern. I think it is low-hanging fruit. I think that it's something that needs to be reviewed, but I think that reviewing it at a time when we're already doing legislative changes, so whether that's 2021, which I would imagine would be the case, I would be okay with that because I don't think that there's anything here that's like super pressing. But as I watch, and board staff can update the committee on this, but as we watch the quorum issues that we're having, we're having licensees that again, we may review it at the committee, but by the time it gets to the board, there's not quorums, or I think we're going to run into quorum issues here at the committee level very quickly, especially if term appointments are not of priority right now, given the public health stuff. We're going to run into quorum issues, and that really does affect the licensees, and it affects our protecting our public and our ability to do so. So those are my thoughts. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Dr. Davey, so the first thing I think would be almost I completely agree with all your concerns, first off, and thank you for bringing this to the attention of the full committee. I think I have questions pretty much about A through E, and some are directed towards board staff, but understanding the board staff have not don't necessarily have extensive tenure either. Maybe Ms. Galvin might be the best source of information. But on the full board, when a committee's two consecutive terms are complete and an appointment has not come from the governor's office, is there some sort of stay that's in effect, or is there some sort of process and that individual stays on board until the appointment is made? What do we typically see in that respect? I'll pause there for an answer before I move on to others.
And Dr. Davey, go ahead, Ms. Govan.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that. My bigger question added to that is the no more than two full consecutive terms even a requirement at the board level? So, Ms. Galvin, I'll let you answer that.
Okay, so Dr. Davies' question first was, are you allowed basically to continue to serve at the committee level if no one has been appointed to replace you? And because you are a statutory committee, you can continue to serve at the committee level. And Dr. Davis Wilson, I didn't understand your question.
For the psychologists and public members, do they have a restriction? So A states a committee member may not serve more than two full consecutive terms, but that's specific to behavior analysts. On the full board, you know, they can serve more than two consecutive terms, correct? By appointment.
Right. Yes, and there was a statute passed, Heidi, maybe a few years ago, that limits several board members to two terms, but psychology was not included in that. It did apply to, like, the medical board and osteopathic physicians, but it did not apply to psychology.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't aware of that.
To that effect, we can maybe look to strike that line, or maybe the rule writers put that in because they felt as if that was the way the winds are blowing.
Dr. Davey, I think that if I recall from when we as a committee worked with the lobbyists, not we as a committee on behavior analysts, but when the steering committee worked with the lobbyists on that specific section, one of the conversations was that there was still concern about appropriate representation of the field, and if somebody was in this position for many, many years to come, that could adversely affect the intent of the committee. And so I do agree with you that possibly striking might be the solution. I'm not here to take one side or the other, but my point is that when it's inconsistent with the full board, this could present problems. And so having this in here, in my opinion, creates an inconsistency that may present problems in the future.
Agreed.
And Madam Chair, if I may also,
No, go ahead. I was just agreeing.
I just wanted to offer just a little bit of perspective, having served another regulatory board for a number of years that spanned a period of time where three different governors had, of course, the authority to make appointments. And so because appointments are made entirely at the governor's discretion, you serve at the pleasure of the governor and so forth, it is entirely possible that a governor, this governor, a future governor, will look at the composition of a board or a committee and make the determination that, you know, someone can be appointed to three, even four, possibly consecutive terms, or potentially allow other interested individuals to serve and, you know, limit the length of time effectively that someone is permitted to serve. So that discretion, I think, of the governor needs to be acknowledged on some level. I have seen governors who permitted individuals to serve a term or two terms. When their term concluded, their successor served for a period of time, and then the original individual reapplied and was appointed again after a gap of some years. So I think we need to defer to that factor somewhat.
Ms. Pacman, I agree. And that's why I think that having it formally stated might be problematic, but I agree with kind of just keeping it consistent with whatever the governor would see. And again, recognizing that, for those of us who have now been in the trenches, it takes a good two and a half years to even figure out what we're, you know, what we're doing and how the meeting process goes and, you know, what are the meeting, the rules of order for the meeting and what have you. So I just want to make sure we're not creating
undue barriers in this particular statute, but agree that if we were to strike it, that it would still be something that would be at the mercy of the particular governor at the time. Dr. Davey, did you have additional questions?
Just a couple of comments. I think obviously B makes a lot of sense. C, the training on the open meeting and ethics makes sense. Hey, D is odd to me because it's my understanding that committee members do not receive reimbursement for their time working on committee. Is that incorrect, or is this relating to something else?
Dr. Davey, and I'll let board staff take that. I believe that the reimbursement for that particular statute is referring to consistency across all committees. And because the other committees are also not paid, then it's that consistency. But it's also referring to, like, travel and those types of reimbursements, which we do have for committee members. So if we have a committee member that is in need of travel and those expenses, that does fall under D as well. Ms. Pacman or Ms. Galvin or Ms. Michelson, do you guys have additional information on that?
I am trying to dig into the recesses of my memory from my time with the Board of Physical Therapy. So that board lacked statutory authority, interestingly. They could never reimburse their members for the many hours of research and the many hours participating in meetings. But there was a general statute that prescribed a reimbursement or compensation, I think, for board members. Jean, do you know what I'm referring to?
Cool. And I'll just add one other piece of information. Chapter 4, Article 2, Title 38, is clearly, once you get into the subsections, all about travel expenses and lodging and receipts for transportation, not necessarily the time.
Yeah, I know I'm going to need some time to do some research into this unless Jean has the answer ready.
I would just say that it makes more sense for me to read, committee members shall receive travel reimbursement for all travel-related expenses, just for clarity, if we're into fixing something. It's not that it has to, but otherwise you're going to look at that title to understand what a person is reimbursed for. And so that, again, we can make a note of that for another date. E is probably the more problematic one that Dr. Davis Wilson has brought up. And it's not that the committee would not obtain public input from licensees or their designated representatives prior to a recommendation going forward. But I think the term shall makes that extremely difficult and essentially compelling us that we must, under some mechanism, gain insight from licensees or representatives prior to moving forward with the recommendation to the board. That to me seems extremely cumbersome, having gone through the rulemaking process and other processes over the course of the years. But I'm not sure that that's possible. So I'm not sure if the open meeting notices that say we're discussing it, that licensees are aware of, is considered enough of trying to gather input. But if that's expecting us to send out a survey or do some sort of research prior to that, then I see that as extremely.
Hello? Hello?
cannot be completed as dialed. Please consult your directory and call again, or... Call cannot be completed as dialed. Please consult your directory. Welcome to CenturyLink Conferencing. Please hold while I confirm your passcode. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the seventh person to join the meeting.
The word shall is a little bit confusing for me. And I would add to that is that it was those same stakeholders that that wanted this in here to ensure that they had stakeholder input. And now it's in here and we're not getting stakeholder input. So I agree with you here, and I don't know if Ms. Galvin has anything to add regarding the language of shall, but I think that it should be part of the consideration of what we review and revise.
I believe Ms. Galvin was disconnected. She just sent an email, so she's going to try to call back in.
Okay.
Well, it sounds like we're we need to deal with that. So I think a placeholder for that to be a discussion moving forward. I think that definitely needs to be cleaned up. And we can look to what other committees have. I mean, I don't remember that the public policy committee that I sit on for the full board has to get feedback from the constituents prior to making a recommendation to the full board. I'd also think that the onus would be on the full board to go after stakeholder committees, as the licensees are licensed under the full board, not the committee. And so that would be my view of the situation. And I'm guessing that we'll get some feedback from Ms. Gavin and see what we can do with regard to that.
Yeah, and Dr. Davey, we did have two representatives from AZIAVA on the last call. And hopefully I did it politely, but we really did express the concern of the word shall and the predicament that puts us in, and this is to the same stakeholders that this applies to, expressing the word shall and the problem that puts us in when it's not a reciprocated correspondence, and again did another plea for follow the agendas, come to the meetings. Like, no, there isn't one item that we aren't open to feedback from others on. And so we did ask them to come to the last meeting. We were successful in getting representatives on the call. And I did that plea again. Look, if you guys really want to be a part of this, we're not excluding you. So please do your share to be a part of it. But I think that we have to be very cautious on how we move forward, just knowing again, and knowing the stakeholder, why the stakeholders who got the lobbyists, you know, the steering committee who got the lobbyists who put this in here, knowing their perspective of why this was in here was one of the reasons why I wanted them to be a part of the conversation at the last meeting, because I don't want them to think that we're doing this because we want to move forward without them, but to be very cautious of that. Look, we have time frames, and there's a lot of things that goes back to item A. There's a lot of things that at the time the steering committee developed the language around this with the lobbyists and pushed forward with the bill, we didn't know the things we know now. And I just say that because I think it's very important that that the stakeholders don't feel like we're closing them out in this process, because I do think that they have two things. They have some powerful lobbying abilities, and they have the governor's interest in his
regulatory movements right now. And so I think we do have to be strategic in how we move forward with our approach. Because I don't want any of the language changes to make them feel like they wouldn't be included, because we want them to be included, right? And that's at the forefront of what's important for us as a community, as a committee, but that they've got to understand the restrictions that this puts in place, and that if they're going to, again, not come when we invite them, that we still have to move forward with our work. And so I just want to make sure that when we do develop strategy around this, that we're very cognizant of both the political and the lobbying pieces that would go into play if they felt as though we were making recommendations against them, which is why we invited them to this particular conversation. I don't know how the rest of the committee felt about it, but I feel like the information we provided was well received, and they did not present any concerns related to the concerns we presented to them.
I mean, again, I think, like you said, the onus is somewhat on them as well to be engaged with us and for us to reach out when there are things that we feel like, you know, when we are making decisions or making recommendations that impact our field and our licensees, then we need to communicate with them that we need them. And once that communication and that invitation goes, they need to send the proper representation to be able to have a conversation with us. So we cannot compel them, and I don't think we should be held to that standard of forcing compliance to be able to move something forward. I think we're all on the same page.
And Dr. Davey, I did confirm at the last meeting that the documentation that we have would be sufficient as it stands now. And there is documentation very clearly from board staff, in addition to public notices, in addition to public commenting periods. There is documentation that we have that board staff has related to these attempts. So I definitely think that information will all be helpful for us should any issues arise in the near future. Otherwise, I think that this is, again, legislation that needs cleaned up, but legislative language that needs cleaned up, but can definitely wait until the public health crisis and all that stuff is over. All right. Any last questions or concerns related to this agenda item? Hearing none, I'm going to move on to.
I just wanted to make sure that we acknowledge we did hear the representatives who were at the last meeting. We did hear them say that they were interested in developing a protocol whereby, you know, a specific member of their association acts as a liaison to this committee and for purposes of, you know, attending the meetings, reporting back to the membership. So that seemed to be a positive development. I haven't heard anything more recently about where that matter stands. I did reach out to the group because tomorrow's board meeting agenda has very strong potential for implications for this profession and its future licensees, and I believe someone will be at that meeting tomorrow on the phone from ABI.
Excellent. So, well, that still covers agenda item 11, discussion consideration possible action regarding strategies to improve communications with stakeholders. Dr. Davey, just a brief summary from the last meeting. I had the opportunity after multiple, we had a meeting back in the fall where the committee had directed board staff to seek input from the professional association. And unfortunately, board staff, despite multiple attempts, were unable to get a response from anybody from the professional association. So I work with board staff on developing kind of a contact log related to the current association board, kind of the makeup of the board, the committee leads, those sorts of things, and also introduced board staff to Jessica Painter, who is the association manager, because I felt that maybe Jessica would be a good neutral body that if emails aren't being returned or they're not able to reach board members, that Jessica could help as a liaison for that communication. So that was one of the strategies that we've put into place.
And then I believe I disclosed in the last meeting as well that I did attend a public policy meeting, and at that time did provide also board staff's information. I do sit on the public policy committee, recusing where obviously appropriate, but I did at that time present with the public policy the information to board staff, requesting that they reach out to Ms. Pacnon and establish a line of communication with her. And it sounds like they did take that recommendation, and that Ms. Pacnon and Ms. Folks do both have ways to communicate with the professional association at this point, and that we are having some success with getting them to respond to those attempts to communicate. Any questions? Thank you. Any questions or concerns related to stakeholder communications? Any ideas that anybody came up with in the interim?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to propose that we also reach out to another professional organization that in part represents behavior analysts, and that's Four Corners ABA.
Absolutely. You know, Dr. Stenhoff, I think that that's a really good idea, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. Ms. Pacnon and board staff, prior to AZIABA's inception, there was a professional association that does represent Arizona called Four Corners ABA, and I would agree that they still currently represent Arizona in their own way, and I would agree that finding ways to establish communication with them would be of great interest. That's a great suggestion.
Madam Chair, Dr. Stenhoff, thank you, yes, for calling this to my attention. I tend to think in terms of, you know, the model of one state association, but with especially emerging professions, that's not necessarily the case. So I appreciate knowing they exist, and I'll reach out.
Excellent. Yeah, and great suggestion, Dr. Stenhoff. I don't know how, after all these years, I have not even thought of that. So thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Any other questions or concerns related to stakeholder communication? Excellent. Moving on. Number 12, new agenda items for future meetings. I have one, and that is just going to be specific to the outcome of tomorrow's meeting, just to make sure that the committee is kept in the loop related to tomorrow's meeting, because they were not invited to it, correct? It's a full board meeting.
That is correct. I will send the agenda to the committee members. The agenda was crafted around a flurry of orders issued by the Arizona Department of Health Services and, of course, our governor that address basically give the board the latitude, the authority to waive certain licensure requirements for the duration of the publicly declared emergency, to relax some of the temporarily relax the testing requirements, and so forth. So it's sort of this convergence of orders that have maybe some degree of coordination, but it's definitely it's uncharted territory, I think, for a lot of boards to sort of think in these terms. The agenda presents a number of considerations for the board to potentially make. They don't have to address all of them. So it's the outcome of this meeting is going to it's going to necessitate the generation of a great deal of guidance that all kinds of people are going to be interested in, our licensees of both professions, our applicants of both professions, patients impacted by these issues and these decisions. So it's quite a bit of material that'll be considered.
So is it true, though, that could the committee members that are not full board members just attend as public members or public participants?
or is it a closed meeting?
Oh, no, it's an open meeting. They can absolutely attend.
Ms. Pacman, are all those meetings telephonic now? Do you guys have, will they be able to call in?
Yes, and what we're doing now to make sure that the public is aware of that, their attendance, their that accommodation for their attendance, when you go onto the news and meeting page of our website, with each meeting posted, we're including very prominently the call-in instructions.
Okay. That makes sense. That used to be the way that it was always done. We could attend in any of the meetings as public members, and then like 2 years ago or whatever, it required that if you weren't on the agenda, you had to be in person. But given the time, all right. So yeah, so I definitely think if those board members are unable to attend, or if the committee members are unable to attend tomorrow, which is fine, I would still like to see an update on the agenda for the next meeting. I do have another agenda item. The application requires the attestation, or the supervisor form requires the attestation that the individual was observed at least once in a two-week period. The BACB has changed that standard, and so I'm wondering if we need to revisit that supervision attestation and potentially reword that question to meet the new standard. So that would be to add the supervisor form to the next agenda for review and possible edits. And I don't know if board staff, if we want to work on that ahead of time with what those possible edits could be. But I think that since the standard is no longer once every two-week period and instead is twice in a 30-day period, I just want to make sure that we're asking that question consistently with the standard.
Yes, so we'll put it on the agenda. And Kathy, she has a talent for creating and revising our various forms. So I'll work with her to make sure that we have at least a mock-up for you to react to, which I think makes the process more efficient than just sort of, you know, a blank slate and, you know, wordsmithing ensues during the discussion. So we'll draft something and present it to you for your consideration.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other agenda items for future meetings? All right. Hearing none, we will move on to agenda number 13. Do we have a motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Excellent. Thank you guys so much. There was a good meeting. We had a lot.